solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
So I say leadership in the 21st century is not a noun, it's not a title, it's not a position, it's actually an act, it's a verb. Okay. And that act is something that every human being is capable of. And so I give examples like Padma Shri. I give an example of a young boy from who lives in a slum, a garbage dump in Ahmedabad, and goes to a Teach for India school. I give example of a young mentee of mine who's now a successful young woman who started Kids for Code, etc. And I said, look, none of these cases did they have any formal authority. Nobody asked them to do what they did. They felt a calling. They decided to act on it. And they've accomplished far more than what they would have imagined and what the world imagined they could accomplish. And so to me, this is the most powerful, inspiring model for how we create a functioning society, how we create a functioning planet, which is leadership comes from anywhere and everywhere. It's ordinary people doing extraordinary things, not about extraordinary people. And I lay out what are the steps by which you can get started.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to the 87th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. And as many of you know, this podcast is a labor of love for the long term, where I have conversations with leading practitioners, thinkers, authors, artists, sportsmen, and many other leaders in their respective fields to decode insights around leadership, transitions, and careers. In addition to curating this podcast, I work with leaders with a growth mindset as a trusted sounding board, helping them and their organizations transform and play to their unique potential. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Now to the guest of this podcast. It's Ravi Venkatesan, and I've had the opportunity to know Ravi over the last several years. In fact, he was one of the first few guests of this podcast. The last time he was here, we'd spoken about some of his corporate transitions, including from Cummins to Microsoft and to some of the board roles. We then subsequently interacted during my work with Social Venture Partners, a nonprofit that I'm associated with that works with several organizations and engages people like me to lend different forms of capital to nonprofits. In fact, Ravi was the person that brought that to India. I reconnected with him in the context of his recent book, What the Heck Do I Do With My Life? His first book, Conquering the Chaos, was targeted at leaders of MNCs in India and on how they can navigate the vagaries of the Indian market. But this recent book has a very different target audience. It's anyone who's on a career journey. On one hand, it has insights for people who are straight out of college. On the other, it has insights for leaders who've had a successful career and are thinking about what next, what's the next mountain I should climb, and to all the people in the middle in that wide spectrum. I specifically enjoyed three things in our conversation. First is the notion of punctuated equilibrium and the impact it has on us. Second is a phenomenon of starting that we observe in the animal kingdom and how it impacts how we think about projecting ourselves. And third is a point around being intentional about life. And Ravi expands on these three and much more in this conversation. You will find several thoughts here that will clarify your perspectives and hopefully get you to ask better questions in your respective journeys. Without further ado, let's listen and learn from Ravi Venkatesan. Ravi, great to have you back at the Play to Potential podcast. Excited to be speaking to you in the context of your newly launched book.
Yay, thanks. I'm thrilled to be back. It's been quite a few years since we were formally in conversation.
Correct. I think to give you a sense of the context and the journey, we've Over the last 5+ years, we've had about 85 plus speakers, and I think you were speaker number 8 in that journey. So good to have you back.
And congratulations on the traction you've had with Play to Potential. It's just become so popular and so discussed and so aspirational. So well done.
Thank you, Ravi. Ravi, let's dive into the book, What the Heck Do I Do With My Life? You say that this book has been in the pipeline for 10 plus years. So give us a sense of the evolution of this book and maybe how you ended up with this title.
Yeah. Well, as I described that journey in the preface to my book, but essentially, as you know, at Microsoft, where I was from 2004 to 2011, we used to do these large employee gatherings, typically once or twice a year, and I would talk about the business and what we need to accomplish. But then I would always end up spending about 15-20 minutes reflecting on larger questions of life, career, and so forth. And that would always resonate quite well, much more than the business chat that I would give, the homily I would give. And as I left the company and over the years, I found that a lot of what I said and those experiences stuck with Microsofties, and that's what they would fondly remember and miss. So I said, oh, this is great. So I should continue to find forums and avenues to do it. And I remember in 2013, early 2013, I wrote a series of articles on sort of the challenge of making such a transition. And I reflected on the central challenge being one of identity. So if you're not sort of, a journalist, you're not a CEO, you're not an entrepreneur, whatever, then who are you? And that series of articles in Economic Times did exceptionally well with over 1 million readers. And people would come up to me in an airplane and say, hey, are you Ravi Venkatesan who wrote that article? And I'd say, yeah. So keep writing. We really like that. And so I got encouraged, and then I continued. LinkedIn was becoming more prominent, so I continued writing and posting on LinkedIn. And these, while I wrote about many things, those other things would get 5,000, 10,000 views, and these would do 50,000, in one case, 3 million views. So wow. I said, look, the subject is something that is close to everybody's heart. And then by 2015, I decided there's probably a book out here. So the book project, as a concept, is about 5 years in the making. And the original title was something else. But by 2017-18, when I decided to formally look for a publisher, they said, okay, you need a title. So I said, working title is, What the F Do I Do With My Life? and then as we were coming close to the end, where it had to go to print, we said, what do we do with the title? Well, we said, it actually seems to be quite a good title, except we'll change one word. And that's how
I understand. Understood. Before we get into the book, Ravi, one of the questions I'm curious about in the work I do and in the podcast is, how people think about their pie chart of time and attention. And if we sort of go back to that point where you moved away from your full-time role at Microsoft to today, can you talk a little bit about some of the key choices you've made along the way? Specifically, I think even in the book, you call out a couple of things you said no to, but I'm curious about how you've thought about choices in that span.
So when I was leaving Microsoft, one of the choices I made at that time is not to immediately plunge into one more thing just like this. I had very little idea of what I wanted to do. There were some sort of thoughts, but nothing really fleshed out. And the only thing I was clear and determined not to do was to become an employee again with a full-time job and all that goes with it, pluses and minuses. I remember talking to Nandan Nilekani at that time, who's been a friend and mentor over the years. And he said, the fundamental choice you have to make is whether you want to do one thing or you want to do multiple things. So, okay. I said, but look, right now I want to try many things, okay? Because, and I write about that in the book, which is when you come to a fork in the road and you don't know what to do, then it's very important to try micro experiments, lots of little things, and then see what fits. And that's what I began in 2011-12. And so I would say that when I look back, the pie chart of my time back then looked like quite a few corporate boards. So Infosys, and then there was Volvo and Bank of Baroda and what, you know, those sorts of things. And that took up probably 70% of my time. I began my experiments in the social sector, starting with social venture partners. And then with a friend, Will Poole, we started Unitas Ventures. So those kinds of experiments. I joined the board of Rockefeller in 2014. So I would say those things took about, you know, 10-15% of my time. And then my previous book and then the writing effort was the balance. Now, by 2018 is when I think I made the next big pivot. When I said, look, I'm, you know, the social sector stuff, you can't really hope to make any difference unless you're all in, you're really committed. So I made the big shift to dial down the corporate engagement and dial up the commitment to the dev sector. And so today, the pie chart of my activities is probably about 70% development and social sector. About 20% is right now with the book project. And the corporate engagement is very, very small, largely with Hitachi.
And back to the advice from Nandan, who's also been on the podcast in the past, the one big thing versus portfolio, given your lived experience and the conversations you have with leaders who are going through this transition after having accomplished a lot of things in life, any guiding principles on what kinds of people are better off with a one big thing and what kinds of people are better off going down the portfolio route?
It's an interesting question. I think that, as you correctly have surmised, there is no right answer. It's, you know, what fits. But I do think that as you get older, so as you cross, you know, late 40s, 50, I think it is a little constraining for most people to just do one thing. After 50, even though we're living longer lives, Deepak, there's a lot of uncertainty. And so you need to start optimizing for the thing that is most precious, which is time. Okay. And so if you approach this saying, look, I have now a much more finite amount of time left. And how do I want to spend it? How do I want to optimize it so that when I look back, I won't have regrets? I doubt you would choose to do just one thing. Okay. I would say the answer is very different when you're in your 20s and 30s, where you still, you know, have that drive to achieve, the achievement orientation. And achievement is very much correlated with focus and intensity and so forth. So so the second mountain, if you will, I think is generally better supported by having a portfolio of things that engage you. That's my sort of compromise anyway. And I also think that there is a certain joy that comes with being more in control of your time. Okay. So the fact is, today I'm not feeling very productive. I'm not going to write. Okay. I'm going to do something else. I'm going to read, or I'm going to take off somewhere or whatever. Oh, today is Sunday, but I'm feeling very, very productive. So I'm actually going to just do whatever I need to do. This freedom and flexibility, I think, is ultimately where you want to be, rather than on a treadmill where somebody else has the hand on the control. You know, and so that also suggests that you're better off with a array of things.
That's a great point. I guess it's also about autonomy and control and independence at some level as we age. Lovely. Let's dive into the book, Ravi. The one term that caught my attention, which I haven't really come across in any other piece of work on transitions, is this notion of punctuated equilibrium. Can you say more about what it is? And I think as I was reflecting on it, the question in my head was, how do we know there's an equilibrium on the other side, given what we're going through? So I'd be curious to maybe if you could just lay out what the term means and talk a little bit about how you see it.
Yeah, look, there's a dinosaur on the cover of the book, and people, you know, often say, what is that dinosaur doing on the cover? And that goes back to this question of punctuated equilibrium. So this is a term from natural history. And when you look at the sort of fossil record, essentially what you see is occasional periods of extreme change, which are often correlated with mass extinctions. And then things get stable again for a while. And then again, another period of extreme change. So that's why it's called punctuated equilibrium. Generally, they're long, stable periods. And then there's some shock, some event. And when this event happens, then a lot of sort of life struggles to adapt. And they become either marginalized or become extinct, like the dinosaur. And then, you know, some other life forms which are able to adapt flourish and become more dominant. And going back to that same extinction during the Jurassic, the mammals became dominant. And so I said, look, that's a pretty good metaphor for what's going on right now. We've had about nearly 100 years of relative stability, certainly 75, 80 years of relative stability, and a rising tide of prosperity in many parts of the world. And now we are in a period of sudden and extreme change. And, you know, in the book, I say that the world will change more in this century than all of human history. And that's really the effect of compounding, you know. Mm-hmm. And this extreme change is driven by so many different forces, you know, the planet reacting to our misbehavior, you know, the crumbling planet, climate change, all that, and how we have to adapt to that. This technology and the way it is driving profound, profound change. There's also very, very new ideas about everything, about what is success, you know, how we should organize ourselves. You know, the ideas about whether India should remain a secular country or not. And so all over the world, there is ferment. Okay. And so this is a period of extraordinary change, and most people are not designed or equipped to handle such change, which is why today, if you look around, there's a lot of anxiety, there's a lot of bewilderment, there's mental health issues, depression. COVID is a superb example of punctuated equilibrium, a sudden shock which affects every human on the planet. And we're going to have many, many more of these types of events. So, so the whole central thesis of the book is the title of chapter one, adapt or perish, adapt and flourish. Okay. So if you can adapt, there's probably been no better time to be alive, because there's just so much opportunity, so many possibilities and all that. But at the same time, if you're unable to adapt, you're saying, why is this happening? Why can't we just go back to the good old days? Why can't somebody rescue me and fix these things? Then the chances are it's not going to be too good.
And diving into one of the concepts you discuss in the book, Ravi, you refer to Charles Handy, and you talk about the three kinds of roles that he says will exist in the future: creatives, caregivers, and custodians. I like the framing as these three. Can you say more about how you see these and the implication for individuals to pick a pathway as we go through our journeys?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Charles Handy over the decades. It's just a lot of both vision and wisdom in his work. And so when I read this, I said, aha, this fits. It's exactly what I've been experiencing and noticing, except I have not articulated quite as well. So yeah, I see. I do think that the vast majority of what we call work will fit into one of these three categories. So you can think about creation as all forms of creation. So people who are writing software, people who are creating content of different sorts, people who are building businesses, people who are inventing, that's the creative. And I think there's going to be a flourishing of creative work of all sorts. Then you have frontline workers who are what he calls caregivers, and they're all sorts. Mm-hmm. So this is the sanitation workers, this is the nurse on the front line, and the teacher, and so on and so forth. And there's going, despite automation, I don't think there's going to be a substitute for that human touch, that human interface. So there'll be a lot of frontline workers. And then, you know, you do need to organize in some fashion. So I don't think companies in the way we recognize or organizations are going to go away. And you need a set of people to manage infrastructure, processes, and so on and so forth. So there'll always be what we broadly call the category of managers. But that number is going to be sort of smaller and probably smaller over time. And so so not only will work largely fall in these three buckets, and therefore it's useful for you to reflect on which am I most likely, what am I best suited to, but also more and more of all of us will just be independent freelancers. Not everybody is going to be an entrepreneur, but very few of us are going to be in long-term stable employment contracts. So that's going to be another feature of this future of work. And finally, there's going to be sort of, I suspect, greater and greater inequality. So for instance, if you're a superb creator, and there's a lot of value people see in your creativity, then the chances are you're going to be able to monetize that exceptionally well and be fabulously wealthy. On the other hand, if you're mediocre, then you know you're essentially not going to do too well in any of these categories. So the unlike in our generation, where there was a large middle for people who were moderately okay, I think we're going to see more binary outcomes going forward. So being excellent is, I think, really important, regardless of which of these categories you fit into. I'm sorry for giving such a long-winded response.
No. It's a great point. I think this came up in a different conversation as well. I was talking to a photographer, a gentleman named Atul Kasbekar, in the conversation as well. And he said the same thing. The sort of the one who's at the top of the pole will get the contracts or the assignments. But the next in line, there's just so much supply that you just get crowded out and commoditized in that space.
Yeah, like they said, who was the second man to set foot on the moon? There's a vast difference between one and two, and then an even vaster gap between two and everyone else. Yeah, and it's not fair. It doesn't feel sort of morally just, but that's just the way it is.
And the way I think about that, Ravi, therefore, the onus is higher on picking something where you will naturally drive yourself to become excellent, right?
Yeah. So, in fact, I was talking to a young audience, and one of them said, look, you know, I really need your advice. I'm mediocre at everything. Okay. Not good at studies. I don't have any exceptional. So what do I do? And I think the answer out of mediocrity is to follow your passion and curiosity. And which I write a lot about, and, you know, not live your life by somebody else's expectations of what you should be doing and so on and so forth, but have the courage to sort of figure out what you're best suited for in terms of what you enjoy, what you're good at. And they're more likely to be excellent rather than mediocre, more likely to be successful and sustain that over the years if you follow that path.
So true. I think the way sometimes I think about it is, you know, we all face the two questions, where to go and how to grow at different points in time. I just feel that from a weightage perspective, the where to go question has become a lot more critical to solve today than it was maybe 30 years back, you know, because the stakes are so high.
Hence the book.
Lovely. I think the other phrase that you use a lot in our conversations, Ravi, and also in the book, is about being intentional about our lives. Can you say more about what that term means to you?
Yeah. So I think a lot of people, or people I know, friends, family, colleagues, just sort of drift through life. Okay. They're like a piece of wood carried along by a stream. Now, when that stream was sort of a gentle one, as it has been for some decades, that you can probably get away with it, you know? But when that stream is a very, very fast-moving one with, you know, lots of currents and waterfalls and this sort of thing, then the chances of you being ending up in some bad place are quite high. So I say, look, you can't afford to sleepwalk through life. You can't afford to just drift through life. And I think it is imperative right now, given the amount of change, to be more aware, more thoughtful, more intentional about a whole set of issues. So, for instance, what do I want to do with my life is certainly one that you should be more thoughtful about rather than just grimly hang on to something that pays the bills. that won't last. How do I want to measure success? Now, that's a question that everybody on this podcast probably has thought about, or they wouldn't be here. But for a lot of other people, they're living life implicitly by success criteria set by somebody else. Who do I spend time with? Okay, and time is precious. And as I write, quoting somebody else, you're the sum total of the five people you spend most time with. So if they're going to be so influential in your thoughts, beliefs, and what happens, then you better choose wisely. Where do you get your information from? Who do you trust in a world filled with polarizing figures and fake news and false information? I think it's incredibly important that you think about this rather than just believe every WhatsApp that comes your way and every demagogue who's screaming on TV or whatever. I say it's even more important to go under the surface and examine your beliefs. What do you believe to be true and untrue? These things have happened over time without you recognizing it. It's like malware that has attached itself to your mind. Mm-hmm. And you need to go back and sort of test whether these beliefs are in fact true or should you change them. What do you pay attention to in your question? So paying attention to what you pay attention to is important because so I just make the case that I think at this moment in time, it is very, very consequential to be slightly more intentional about these issues. And in fact, the main purpose of writing this book is to provoke people to think and become more intentional. I don't, mind if people say, look, this is rubbish. I disagree with that. That doesn't apply to me. Sure, that's all fine. But I'm thrilled that you're at least thinking about it. Okay.
Very true. It reminds me of a conversation I had with a client. At the outside, I walked up to him and said, why me? He said, till recently, I wasn't even aware that where to go was a problem to be solved, you know?
Yeah.
And to your point, I think you're right. I think just bringing the problem to people's consciousness itself is a feat.
Yeah. And no matter what choices they make, they will make slightly better choices, down the road. And yeah, things will be discernibly better.
Hmm. This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. When we are on some of these long journeys, sometimes we don't quite appreciate the frog in the boiling water syndrome playing out. The context around us shifts really slowly, and we don't even see it, and fast forward 10 years, we end up finding ourselves in a funny place. I'm reminded of an advice I got when I was at McKinsey. One of the senior partners would say that you should always choose to continue in the firm every 2 years. He would say that it's a free market and you should speak to your contacts and see what other opportunities exist, and then choose to recommit and pursue a path in the firm. Given there's so much dynamism in the market and in the world outside, and in the journey within the firm, there's a great opportunity to refresh the thinking and decision rather than just hurtling forward by default. The other thing that struck me was the point Ravi makes around attention and meta-attention. I had an opportunity to speak to Rich Fernandez, CEO of Search Inside Yourself, a leadership development program incubated in Google. He speaks about this here.
Attention is simply the directing of your mental faculties to an object of focus or attention. And so this is something we all of us do every day. But something that was found in the research is that about half the time, 47% of the time, our minds also wander away from what we're doing. So though we may be focused on something specific, we also get distracted quite easily, on average about half the time. And so meta attention is, if attention is the quality of directing the faculty of attention or focus, meta attention is becoming distracted and then knowing that you're distracted. So in some ways you could say it is attention of attention, knowing when your attention has wandered, knowing when your mind has wandered, and then bringing it back to full attention. So that's the difference between attention and meta-attention. Focused attention is direct attention, is that quality, like I said, of focused, directed attention. But when we talk about focused attention in the book and in our curriculum, we talk about it as a skill that you can develop. And there's a set of exercises you can use to cultivate it. And that is simply, it's very similar to meditation. You could sit and watch your breathing, for example. And we use the breathing as an object of attention when we're cultivating focused attention, because it first of all, it's available to everybody. And you don't have to believe in anything to focus on it. And so you can focus on your breath. And studies have shown that when you do focus on your breathing, you activate the attentional networks in your brain, the direct attention networks in your brain. Mm-hmm. And so focused attention is an exercise to cultivate sustained attention over time. And open monitoring, as you pointed out, is a slightly different exercise. There is a quality of attention there, but it's not directed at a single object. It's actually kind of opened up and directed much more broadly. That's much more about noticing the perceptual field. So allowing yourself, for example, to simply notice what you notice. I'm not speaking in riddles here. I'm just trying to explain what it means to like notice your own perceptions. That is open monitoring. So what are you thinking in this very moment? What are you feeling in this very moment? What might physically you be experiencing in this very moment? Your attention moves to all of these different factors throughout, as you know, moment by moment, second by second. So becoming aware of how your attention is shifting and moving is the process of open monitoring.
Back to what Ravi says, what we pay attention to influences what we end up doing. What we end up doing ends up building our habits, and these habits and behaviors end up shaping our lives. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Ravi. The other piece you talk about a lot is mindsets, Ravi. I think in the book you referred to Gandhiji and you urge us to focus on goals and possibilities rather than resources and constraints. I was curious. I come from a middle-class family. My father was a public sector banker. And in some levels, from a resources perspective, clearly I come from a world, definitely not from abundance, maybe adequateness, if I may say. It was in scarcity. But I was curious about, when did you hit that inflection point in your life? And number two, how have you learned about cultivating an abundance mindset, even if we come from a situation of, let's say, material scarcity?
Yeah, well, most of us in that generation of India come from exactly the back, not most, the lucky ones of us came from that background of just about adequateness and a great emphasis on learning. This is not a new idea. I was looking at this line from Browning, the poet Robert Browning. He says, "A man's reach must exceed his grasp." Okay. Then Gandhiji says, "Find the purpose, the means will follow." Then then one of my mentors was late Professor C.K. Prahlad, and he influenced me a lot. And he always used to emphasize to everybody, resourcefulness matters more than resources. Okay, and that stuck with me. And if you look at companies that become great, entrepreneurs who build businesses being scrappy, they all start out with an idea that and a vision, a dream, which vastly exceeds the the initial resources. Okay, but somehow they're able to, over time, accumulate or attract enough resources to build something substantial. So I looked at these, and so I first made the intellectual shift that this is actually very true. Then, of course, comes the hard part of applying it to your own life and changing. And so my changes began more in terms of taking on endeavors which were ambitious, and where the starting resources were tiny. Our experience starting Social Venture Partners together is a good example of that. Just an idea, two people, no resources. And then you have a big event like Fast Pitch Friday, where, you're able to mobilize so much resources and so much talent and so forth. So my first experiences were, Microsoft, let's set some incredibly audacious goal that doesn't seem possible. In fact, most people said this guy is going to get sacked because there's no way we're going to get there. But what you believe is what you achieve. So in the business setting, in my professional setting, I began to see that this is absolutely true. Then the challenge comes, the ultimate challenge is applying it to yourself. So I used to feel, somewhat insecure about money, and it didn't matter how much money you have. It's a mindset of insecurity. And then I spent about 6-7 years over the last decade cultivating an abundance mindset, and I actually put practical steps in the book on that. Then I realized it's not just around money that you have scarcity and abundance. It's about everything. And for me, the next mountain on this is time. I feel incredibly scarce on time because I have so many things to do, so much to accomplish. So I'm always watching the clock, and I'm always in a hurry, and family and friends get a little frustrated with that behavior. So this applies, I think, to all sorts of things, to expertise, to love, any number of things that abundance, scarcity, I think you first make the intellectual shift, and then you follow with your actions. You internalize. Did I answer the question? I'm not sure.
It does. I think, in this podcast, I was talking to this lady from Harvard Business School called Ashley Willens. She's written a book about this notion of time poverty. And she says, when you experience time scarcity at some level, you start feeling a bit like, it starts looking, the unhappiness seems a bit like material poverty at some level, while you have all the material possessions. So I think you're right. There is it is a multidimensional problem, the scarcity and abundance, not just the monetary problem.
Yeah, no, Nipun Mehta of Service Spaces, he talks about so many forms of capital, of which money is just one and probably not even the most important.
Talk about that, Ravi? I was going to ask you about the different forms of capital later, but since you bring it up, can you talk a little bit about, the one thing that struck me, especially in my journey at Social Venture Partners, is, sometimes you can open connections, sometimes you can bring in your capability, and there are just different vectors along which one could think about making a difference. So can you expand this notion of multiple forms of capital?
Yeah, So multiple assets, multiple forms of capital shows up in different ways. So, for instance, your friend who's also been on the podcast, Linda Grattan.
Yes.
She does a very good job talking about the importance of cultivating intangible assets.
And yes.
Look, many of us think about our financial assets, but other things like your expertise, your reputation, your networks, your close relationships, your health, your self-knowledge, all these things are even more important. And you better be intentional about cultivating these things as well. It's a powerful idea. Very few people even think about it, let alone do it. So that's one manifestation of this multiple forms of capital or assets. Then Nipun Mehta's sort of construct, which is more about when you're giving, you're helping, you're serving. It's not just money you bring to it, because the world needs much more than just money. So are you bringing love? Okay. Are you bringing energy? Are you bringing expertise? Are you bringing networks? So these are all different forms of capital, and all of them are powerful and greatly needed. And so he comes at, when you're serving, don't just think about money. Think about all these other forms of capital that you have that you're bringing to the table. I find it very, very powerful. And that's the essence at SVP, right? Of course, we bring a little bit of money. It's catalytic. But fundamentally, what we bring to the not-for-profit world is the talent, the energy, the expertise, the networks of all our partners. So, but true, we had never articulated it that way. But
And even yesterday, since you referred to fast pitch, we'd picked 12 organizations. We'd helped them develop a sharp pitch in less than 5 minutes. They presented. But to me, what was most inspiring was the fact that there were about 600 plus people, CSR and philanthropists, that attended the presentation. And hopefully that triggered something in them. So to your point about being catalytic, hopefully they will go on to do either contributing to these 12 or do something else as they move forward.
Yeah, the problem, I missed this fantastic event, but to me, I suspect that for the NGOs that got to present or at any stage of the process, the single biggest thing is self-belief. That today they believe more strongly what their potential is, what they're capable of. And all the other things are important, but this belief is what I think is going to propel them forward. So that's a different form of capital.
So true. So true. Just maybe staying with this for 30 more seconds. I worked with one of the organizations, Maya Care, that works with people with disability and helps the elderly in providing services. And we were coaching an individual who was in a wheelchair and who hadn't presented on this kind of stage. To see him present and to sort of really walk away with that belief, it's quite powerful. I hadn't quite framed it in my head, but that's hopefully that makes a difference in their trajectory moving forward.
I think it makes a trajectory to everyone, though that person, but also all of us who get to observe this.
Of course.
It changed,
of course.
It changes us.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman, here again. During the conversation, Ravi refers to an insight from Linda Grattan about different kinds of intangible assets. Here's a short clip of her talking about the different kinds of assets.
Well, as you know, in the book, we talked about three types of intangible assets. We talked about productive assets, vitality assets, and transformation assets. And I think really, in your 40s, the productive assets become really important because you need to keep on learning. You need to keep on building new skills. You need to be saying to yourself and to the labor market, I'm still somebody who's got a lot to offer from now until the age of 70. So that's really crucial. But also, of course, transformational assets. And those are, as we said earlier, transformational assets are a lot to do with your network.
Even with networks, I think there's an opportunity for us to think about the different kinds of networks we engage with. Herminia Ibarra, also a professor at London Business School and the author of Working Identity, has an interesting frame for us to think about the different kinds of networks we interface with.
Sure. I mean, we do, past a certain point in our careers, we do everything through relationships. That's how we get things done. That's how we find out what's going on. That's how we get advice, perspective, everything. And most people who are doing well have very good operational networks that just help them get the day-to-day work done more smoothly. Maybe, you know, they'll get something done faster for them, or they'll get the information they need sooner. But, you know, it is really kind of what's in the critical path of my routine day-to-day work. That's the operational network. The personal network is the part that is, you know, the people you've worked with who've become friends and you've stayed in touch with, and there's more emotional quality to it, or maybe some old mentors, and there's often common interests. They're longer term relationships, and most of us have those too. And then the hard part, the tricky part, is the strategic network, which has to do, you know, if the operational is about you today, the personal often is about your past. The strategic's about your future, and it's about how do you connect the dots between some of your interests and relationships that are maybe external to your company, some of the internal relationships, help connect people, help bridge across different areas, help bring new ideas in, help export new ideas.
My big realization is that very often when we take stock of life, we end up becoming narrow and unidimensional. But things like our physical and mental health, how our children are growing up, our vitality, our relationships with the family and in the network, the trust we have in the ecosystem around us, our reputation, our personal brand, all these are assets which have a material impact on the quality of our personal and professional lives. My wife and I keep discussing that when we look around with this holistic lens, the only emotion that comes up is that of gratitude for the number of things that are going well, and with how some of the intangible assets are coming along. Just pause for a moment here. How do you think about your balance sheet? What items do you put in there? And how do you rate yourself on the various dimensions of the balance sheet that matter to you? Let's now get back to the conversation with Ravi Venkatesan. Moving themes, Ravi. I loved your take on specialists and generalists as well. You know, I love the quote in your book, the world needs birds and frogs. But in an uncertain and fast-changing world, birds can find new habitats and food better than frogs. And generalists will probably end up having more opportunities and can adapt to change better. Can you say more about how you see this specialist and generalist question, and also a little bit around how we should think about this over time? Is there the typical paradigm often is diverge and then converge, you know, diverge to build capability and then converge to exploit those capabilities. How do you think about that?
So, of course, this framing of frogs and birds is Freeman Dyson's. But like everything he said and wrote about, I love it. So look, for a long time, again, when the world was stable, it what was valuable was expertise. Okay, and so it rewarded depth, particularly technical depth in any area. When the world is more fluid, okay, and fast changing, that's both not enough and fairly risky, because whatever expertise you have may suddenly not be so valuable. So for instance, let's say you're an expert and ustad on repairing engines, right? In the world that's rapidly trying to shift to electric vehicles, it could leave you stranded. Okay. So I think what you want to be in this environment is a Swiss Army knife rather than a carving knife or a bread knife or some special purpose knife, because the circumstances and the food sources may change rather suddenly. And so that's the argument I make around generalists versus specialists. But it's not either or so much as, is there a way to integrate both? And I suspect that the answer lies in having somewhat of a T profile, where you have some expertise in some area, but on, and that is what grounds you, that's what, you know, gets you going in your journey. But then on top of that is a horizontal, you know, versatile set of skills. And that probably is the more optimal way of approaching it, is my own sense. Yeah, naturally, I've navigated towards being more of a generalist. And, you know, even back 30 years ago when I was studying at business school, I didn't choose finance or a particular function. I chose general management. And I've enjoyed general management more than something more specialized all my life. And I think it is in large part that which has enabled me to make so many different transitions over the decades.
It's a great point, Ravi. And to your earlier point about, you know, really the, what do you say, the top of the class getting disproportional returns and not having room for mediocrity. So the tension I see is how do you be a Swiss Army knife, but at the same time ensure that you're top of the class of something, you know,
and not
a me too.
That's the paradox that you need to solve. And in my case, for instance, I find that I'm relatively good. I wouldn't say top of the class, but pretty decent at working with people, aligning people, getting people working behind a common goal. And that turns out to be a pretty valuable skill because, you know, 100 years from now, it's probably still going to be relevant. So you need to find whatever equivalent of that is for you.
And I think back to your metaphor about the tea, one of the pieces I learned from Linda Grattan, whom you referred to, was she talks about the notion of a pie, you know, and the nuance she says is, if you look at the symbol pi, the mathematical symbol pi, you've got one leg straight and the other leg in the air. So she says one for stability and one to sort of proactively think about the future. And I thought it was quite interesting.
That's a
lovely. So one's a little bit of a forward-looking hedge, if you will.
Yeah.
Moving topics, Ravi, you work with, you know, game, you've set up game. And one of the themes I've been curious about is how do you get somebody to think and behave like an entrepreneur? And you're trying to do this at scale with game. Can you talk to us a little bit about game, what you're trying to do there, but also what have you learned about building entrepreneurs?
Sure. So, look, the world is going through a period where the supply of jobs will not be able to keep pace with the demand for jobs. Okay. Partly because jobs are, as a construct, as an industrial thing, which is going away as companies want more fluid contracts. And also, we are doing a better job educating larger numbers of people. So, the supply side is increasing handily. So if this supply-demand gap is not short-term, but actually structural and long-term, then what you want to do is get more people becoming entrepreneurs, and both to feed themselves as well as maybe create livelihoods for a few more. And of course, in some parts of the world, entrepreneurship is flourishing. In our own country, it's doing very well in some of the larger cities like Bangalore or Gurgaon. But the question is, is it possible to catalyze this so it spreads like wildfire to our smaller cities, towns, and you know, rural India? So that's the whole purpose of game, and our work is to try and, you know, make it aspirational, get more people to think about this as a conscious choice and number one or two on their choices rather than a government job, and then how do you help them think about an idea and incubate it, and how do you create an environment that promotes growth, so on and so forth. That's what we're trying to do in game. But along the way, we've realized that, look, while not everybody may want to be an entrepreneur or capable of being an entrepreneur, in a very, very fast changing 21st century, Everybody needs an entrepreneurial mindset. Okay, it doesn't matter what you're going to do, but the chances are if you have an entrepreneurial mindset, you'll be more successful. Now, what is it about the entrepreneur's mindset? I think there are four or five things. One is they're able to sense opportunity. Every problem to an entrepreneur is an opportunity in disguise. Okay, to somebody else, every opportunity is a problem. So you want to make help people make the shift. So if there's garbage lying on the streets, oh, it's an opportunity for a waste business. Okay, climate change is the mother of all opportunities. So get them to sense and see opportunity and then act on something that moves them. So that's one aspect of an entrepreneurial mindset. A second one is this idea of resources versus resourcefulness. Okay, don't get crushed by the fact that you don't have resources to start with. How do you bootstrap yourself is a very powerful idea. So for instance, somebody may have an engineering degree from not a particularly good college. They can't find a job, okay? If you have this bootstrap mentality, you'll say, look, I don't mind starting out as a Swiggy delivery person, okay? But that's not where I'm going to end my life. That's just how I'm going to get going and bootstrap myself. And then in the off hours, I'm going to do something else. And then, you know, so that's why I point out that this mindset is very crucial. Problem solving is another thing that every entrepreneur has to do. Every day there are new problems and you better figure out how to solve them fast. That's pretty handy in life as well. Tenacity, not giving up, staying with it till you encounter success is another attribute. So what we're saying is every person will benefit and be more successful if they have some of these mindset and skills. And we found that it's teachable. So my co-founder, Mekin, has done some of the most pioneering work in the world and, you know, in over 1,000 Delhi government schools for 3 years, he and others have been running this entrepreneurship mindset curriculum for young people, grades 9 to 12. And from the sort of most difficult, challenging backgrounds, think about who sends their kids to government schools these days, because even your cook, maid, security guard, driver, they send their kids to English medium schools. So this is the next level of the pyramid. And kids from that environment have flourished. So we have demonstrated and learned that, you know, this is not something you're born with. It is no way correlated to socioeconomic backgrounds. Everybody can learn these skills. Some will become entrepreneurs, most won't, all will be better off.
And of course, this is a large program, but at a headline level, what do you see are the key elements of the curriculum? What does it take? What are the different vectors to think about in terms of unlocking an entrepreneurial mindset?
So these are some of the attributes. So empathy is one. Without empathy, you're not going to be able to connect with an opportunity. Okay. So, if, for instance, one person walks down a street completely oblivious to what's around. Another one looks at all the garbage lying around and is offended by this. The second person is more likely to do something about it. Okay. So how do you teach empathy? How do you people to open up all their senses and feel? So there are ways we do that. It's rare that you're going to be able to accomplish something on your own. Okay, forget entrepreneurship. In this world, very few things require you to be solo. In fact, if you're actually just an IC, your work can probably be most automated. Okay, you're at greatest risk of automation. The more your work is interdisciplinary, collaborative, etc., the safer you are. So learning to work in teams is a very, very crucial skill. So, and that can't be taught in a classroom. So you do it experientially by giving, people projects or tasks to accomplish where they have to work with others. Okay. And through practice, they get better at it. You give them lots of challenges. So in the book, I give the example of how Udyam teaches tenacity. You have to accomplish some complicated task with your non-dominant hand. And it's intensely frustrating to build a paper plane with your non-dominant hand. But no, you are, even if it takes you 1 hour, you and the end product isn't all that great, you stick with it. So now it starts exercising that muscle called tenacity. So every one of these attributes that we have laid out, and there are about 10 of them, can be learned in an experiential way in a relatively short period of time. It's very encouraging.
Lovely, lovely. And you spoke about waste management a couple of times, Ravi, in the book. Actually, I love the your definition of leadership in the book, right? You say it's not an elite calling. It's the unrecognized potential in each one of us. And you speak about what leadership looks like today in the world we live in the context of your neighbor, Padmashree, and how she moved from being a homemaker and a part-time teacher to becoming a leader in the space of waste management. So can you sort of talk to us about this sort of this example of, if I may use the term, everyday leadership, right? And the fact that leaders could come from anywhere. If you could just expand on that.
Yeah, so I make the case, and I devote a whole chapter to this idea that leadership is the central issue of our time. And you look at the world at any level, you know, planet, country, city, neighborhood, company, whatever unit, you'll find that there is lots of problems, but most of the solutions, many of the solutions exist, the resources exist, the talent, know-how exists, but somehow the problem doesn't get solved. It persists and in fact grows bigger. And the reason for that is lack of leadership. Then you think further, why is there lack of leadership? Because our mental model of leadership is completely obsolete and unhelpful, which is it is correlated with people who have title, formal authority, etc. So you expect the government to do something, the politician to do something, the manager to do something, and mostly they don't. Okay, the system is in stable equilibrium because it suits all sorts of people with formal power to keep things the way they are. So if things are going to get better, you have to get many more people not waiting to be rescued and helped, but stepping up and being part of the solution. And that's leadership. So I say leadership in the 21st century is not a noun. It's not a title. It's not a position. It's actually an act. It's a verb. Okay. And that act is something that every human being is capable of. And so I give examples like Padmashree. I give an example of a young boy from who lives in a slum, a garbage dump in Ahmedabad, and goes to a Teach for India school. I give an example of a young mentee of mine who's now a successful young woman who started Kids for Code, etc. And I said, look, none of these cases did they have any formal authority. Nobody asked them to do what they did. They felt a calling. They decided to act on it. And they've accomplished far more than what they would have imagined and what the world imagined they could accomplish. And so to me, this is the most powerful, inspiring model for how we create a functioning society, how we create a functioning planet, which is leadership comes from anywhere and everywhere. It's ordinary people doing extraordinary things, not about extraordinary people. I lay out what are the steps by which you can get started. And again, I go back to young people, young children, and my work with UNICEF, where we go to government schools. We get them involved in civic activities, little volunteering activities, change-making activities of the smallest sort. And that gives them a sense of agency. So the example I give is, you're in a government school, the school toilet hasn't functioned for 3 years. You've complained to the teacher, you've complained to the principal, nothing is happening. There's indifference, apathy all around. So we say, look, why don't you fix it? And in the beginning, there's like shocks. What do you mean I'm fixing it? people will object, or I don't know how to start, or then you organize them, so go find your friends, and then you help them, support them, and pretty soon the toilet's fixed. And you have now developed that agency, that self-control. Oh, I'm capable of doing something about some of my problems. I'm no longer just a passive victim. And by the way, when I decided to go work on this issue, others also joined me because they were vexed by the same thing. They just wanted somebody else to take the lead. And so you develop followership, and that feels pretty good. So through these actions, the flywheel starts, and who knows where it may lead. So I think it's incredibly important that all of us, be part of the solution to some problem that's bugging us. And the other thing I say is, look, this is the mother of all skills in the 21st century. If this is what the world is short of, if you are good at it, okay, you don't have to worry about employment and finding food on putting how to put food on the table or any of these things. People are going to be beating a path to your door. Now, Padma Shri, since you talked about her, I mean, she's the most prominent citizen activist on waste. BBMP, the government, the municipal authority, will not move on any issue without consulting her. Okay, corporates that are thinking about their, waste and recycling issues, they come to her. Entrepreneurs come to her. Okay, she doesn't have to. And if she chose to monetize it, she could. That's not the issue. So I say this is the most useful, durable skill that you could possibly develop.
And maybe just to stay with this example, Ravi, can you talk to us about her journey from her beginnings, just to give the average listener a sense of what's possible?
Well, she just lives a few streets away from me in Koramangala in Bangalore. And her journey began a few years ago, 5-6 years ago, when she got frustrated where, the garbage in front of her house on the street, and, despite complaining, it was there, and it was this ugly, festering, dark spot. So her first action was simply to begin to clear it herself. And then other residents decided, hey, this is terrible. Yeah, you can't have a middle-aged lady doing this. So they joined. And so, in fact, many of us on Sundays in the early days used to get together and beautify these spots. So there was a similar ugly spot in front of our house. And I remember the Sunday in 2015 when whole bunch of people got together, we cleared it, we painted it, and then we put some potted plants so that it would stay clean, and then paint a picture of a god or something so nobody will urinate out there. So you do these things. Then you say, oh, so now we've cleared all the spots. What's next? So you're feeling good about doing this work. Then you take on, plastics, single-use plastics, and say, how do we minimize the use of single-use plastic? Can we get every household now to segregate wet and dry waste? Okay, so it becomes easier to compost the wet and recycle the dry. So each thing leads to something bigger. Right now, what she's leading is what is called a 7-star project in one of the wards in Bangalore. 7-star in Swachh Bharat is the highest level of systemic cleanliness you can achieve. So there is a project which involves civil society, citizens, companies, and BBMP to create Bangalore's first model ward, which is 7-star, with a plan to replicate that success across the city. I mean, wow, it's just unimaginable in just 5-6 years.
Moving forward, Ravi, one of the questions I think about back to our conversation in the beginning around choices is this even if we look at the example of someone like a Mekin and you starting game, and someone like Padma Shri, if I were to relate it to the way I see it, sometimes I find there's an inside out approach to situations where you say these are the things I'm passionate about, these are the things that give me energy. And, let me take a baby step, see where it goes, take another step, see where it goes, and just sort of keep it anchored around where I find my meaning, purpose, and energy. There's the other approach where you start with a big problem, right? Millions of jobs. We need to solve this at scale. We need to have a systemic response. How do we sort of attack this? And then you come up with an approach and you engage. How have you thought about, is it a binary question? I find that certain kinds of people, you know, I got this feedback once that one of my earlier colleagues told me I have an artisanal mindset, and somehow that stayed with me. And even in the way I think about the podcast or the work I do, it's a very, you know, in a way, closer to the Padma Shri approach than the McKinn approach, if I may sort of paint those two paradigms. But how do you think about that, and what's your guidance to people when they are at the crossroads?
I don't know. I always go back to that ikigai diagram of the intersecting circles of what you're good at, what you enjoy doing, and what the world needs and values. And somehow you have to try and find your, swim your way to the intersection of this. And obviously it's not a static thing, it's a moving thing. So I, you know, there's so many opportunities in the world, there's so many challenges in the world. I'm not drawn to many of them. You pay attention to what you're drawn towards, and usually it'll be things that you enjoy doing, and there's some element of what you enjoy and what you're good at in there. So, for instance, my next big mission is in climate change, and it's in particular around energy transition to renewable energy and energy access. And this is a global scale project. Okay, so we all know that there is this problem out there. Why this problem? Well, I look at myself. I intellectually enjoy very, very complex, wicked problems, because it's like a puzzle. So some people like doing Wordle. I like these type of problems. That's me. Okay, so I'm drawn to that. It requires many, many stakeholders to come together and collaborate. Well, that's another thing I both enjoy and I'm fairly good at. I know how to connect and engage and build trust and get people to want to come together behind something. Okay. I have a lot of experience building these types of alliances now, with first with GAME, then globally with UNICEF. So I'm a little further down that journey in terms of having lived and walked it and knowing what mistakes to avoid than many others. So that's a useful skill. So it is that intersection that you need to find. And it's not something that you can sit and think your way towards. You can't sit in a room or chat with a friend and figure it out. You have to experiment your way. One of the phrases I use most often in all my talks and my writing is Deng Xiaoping's phrase, which is, you cross the river by feeling your way across the stones. I think it's the most beautiful metaphor moving in the face of uncertainty. Okay, so you make experiments, and from the feedback of those experiments, you gradually gravitate to this intersection or sweet spot.
I guess just maybe staying with this for a couple of minutes, you know, when even back to your experience, when you're at Microsoft, when you're doing one thing, often the metrics of progress are easy to measure. But when you're doing many things, often it's hard to get a sense of, you know, am I doing enough? Am I moving the needle? And if I see it in my context, right, I think the how do I transition, how do I reinvent is a mass problem. But I'm trying to sort of have a cottage industry kind of an approach to solving a industrial problem, if you know what I mean. So sometimes I wonder if I'm doing enough. So I wonder if how you think about, you know, how do you think about success and metrics as you move forward?
Clearly, I think that's one of the central questions of life. How will you measure your life? And it's not a new question. It's there.
Yes.
The Greek philosophers talked about it, etc. And I've moved, you know, it's also something that evolves if you're intentional. And so my definition of what success is at 30 is very different from what it is at 60. There was a couple of questions actually you intertwined cleverly in your thing. But so there's a broader question of how do you figure out how you're going to define success for yourself? And then I thought I heard a second question, which was embedded, which says, look, when you're doing these kind of complex things, how do you know if you're even making a difference? And Microsoft, you know, market share, growth, profitability, yes, are easy metrics. I think these are two different questions. So on the second one, look, we are tackling incredibly complex systems change issues out there. And so you just show up every day and chip away. And mostly nothing is happening. Okay. And then sometimes suddenly something big will improve. Okay. And that's rather hard to predict and so forth. So you can get very depressed because on a day-to-day, month-to-month basis, you don't see much happening. And that's why I draw courage from Mother Teresa. One of the things she said was, in life, there are no great things. There are just small things done with great love. Okay. And sometimes, you know, something small becomes something big, but there's no way of counting on it or predicting it. And so I say, as Buddha says, the most important thing is to show up and sit. Okay. And something might happen, but if you don't sit, nothing is going to happen. That's guaranteed. So that's how I choose to view it. And so you also need to have a portfolio of things, some of which give you feedback on a daily basis. So going out to the street and being kind to people gives you that kick that you need, that gratification, whereas this long-term stuff may or may not. Also, I've come to the conclusion that none of what I do may actually matter to the world, okay? But it matters profoundly to how I feel about myself. Okay. And therefore, it's worth persisting. Okay. And that has taken some years. Okay. So I'm not under any illusion that we'll create a mass entrepreneurship movement. Obviously, I don't tell funders that. But but it's a very, very tough problem. Okay. And we may, you know, make a dent here and a, you know, scratch there. But it is not at all certain that we will succeed in our mission. But just when I look back at the end of my life, I think I'm going to feel very good about at least having not wasted my life just feathering my nest, but you know, tackling something important. So that's a long-winded answer to that second question on these, how do you measure success? Then, I'm profoundly, profoundly influenced by this one sentence from former professor at Stanford called James Marsh. And, you know, I use that as, I put it everywhere. I have it in front of me right now. It says, look, at the end of, we are very minor blips in a cosmic story. And he says, all our aspirations for importance and significance are just illusions. All our hopes are minor except to us. But some things do matter. Mostly, and what might make a difference to us is if in our tiny roles, in our brief time, we inhabit life gently and add more beauty than ugliness. So for me, this is the most beautiful statement of how you might want to measure your life. And therefore, what all you have to do is get specific about what do I need to do to walk more gently? What does that mean? And given the unique assets that I have, that we talked about earlier, different forms of capital as, how can I contribute to making the world a little more beautiful? Okay. And so I've found my answer to, at this point, to those two questions. And I think this may be a reasonable question for everyone that is searching, which is, you know, your way of doing it is helping people find their potential. Making their lives and the world consequently more beautiful in that process. And that's something you're uniquely capable of doing. So, yeah, that's how I've reasoned my way. I'm not saying this is the answer. This is what has worked for me.
And the one frame, one phrase just to understand, Ravi, when you say walk more gently, what does that term mean to you?
Well, one is be kind, walk more gently on people's feelings and emotions. Walk more gently on the planet, because we're making incredibly irresponsible thuds. What does that mean in terms of our personal consumption, personal habits, and can you be a little lighter? You know, in terms of that, yeah, those would be two examples of walking more gently.
Got it. This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here again. Building on the point Ravi makes around walking more gently, one of my earlier guests, Venkat Krishnan, founder of Give India, speaks with a tremendous sense of vulnerability about the notion of an emotional footprint that speaks to a similar theme.
So kind of like the carbon footprint, right? So I think you leave in your interactions with people, you leave them feeling better or feeling worse. So when you leave people feeling better, you have an emotional positive, what Stephen Covey calls emotional bank account balance. And this idea first occurred to me when I read Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I am a ridiculously low EQ guy. Everything, even emotions, I actually calculate, think about, etc. And I know that I'm going to have hurt far more people in my life than I would have brought joy to, emotionally speaking. I mean, and I'm discounting, of course, that I might have helped somebody get food and therefore they are able to have a happy family and there is an emotional payoff of all of that and stuff like that. I'm discounting that. I'm just looking at more from a personal ecosystem point of view, a bunch of, you know, friends, relatives, family, other people, etc. And if I look at their emotional expectations from me, I'm going to leave most people shortchanged on that in my life. And, you know, it hurts that that's going to happen. But I do keep going back to it periodically. It's difficult to change yourself as you get older, but I've tried and I've made some changes. But, you know, I'm wired the way I am. And my one regret when I finally die is going to be that I will have left a negative and emotional footprint.
I guess there's an opportunity for each one of us to focus not just on the what we do, but how we come across when we do what we do. Let's now get back to the conversation with Ravi Venkatesan. Another term I loved in your book, Ravi, was this term starting. You talk about how a gazelle in the animal world signals its capability. And you also quote Sheryl Sandberg, where she says, develop your voice, not your brand. And you suggest that we need to think marketing and not sales when it comes to signaling our capability in a crowded world. Can you expand on this for us?
Yeah, it's a very fine balance. Okay. So first of all, this is a difficult, unforgiving world in some ways. And so it's not only is it important that you have some skills and be excellent, but the world around you needs to recognize that. And so you have to signal. And that's why I use the metaphor of starting, where the gazelle just goes up and down in the same place while it's grazing. So the leopard knows, don't waste your time. I'm a pretty fit guy and I'm going to outrun you. So go find somebody else who's not able to spring up quite so well. And so you need to find ways to do that without becoming one of these just ugly, relentlessly self-promoting individuals. It's a fine line. You can easily, you know, cross over without even intending to where all you're doing is self-promotion. And I see some very smart, very good people who've lost that plot. But some of it is important. And that's why I like what Sheryl Sandberg says, which is don't talk about yourself or just go on, you know, tweeting or doing something silly. Actually, lead with thought leadership. Okay. So signal with putting out ideas that are well thought through, genuinely useful. And that's a useful way. I've embraced that myself. You know, I'm not out there just relentlessly on social media. I occasionally put stuff out there on LinkedIn and I put a lot of thought and effort into it. And as a result, I think there's a growing number of people who are drawn towards listening to those ideas. What happens then is you build a reputation. And that reputation then attracts opportunities. And so, you know, I think in today's world, it is just a failing strategy to go chasing opportunities, chasing a job, one of these things, okay? The only effective way is to build a reputation and attract people and opportunities to you. And then you can sit there and say, is this interesting or that interesting or not? And that's why I talk about marketing rather than sales. And in fact, that's the way it works. I often get people to do a simple exercise, and maybe some of your listeners would want to do it. You write down all the significant experiences, professional, personal, that you've had, and over the last whatever period of time, 20, 30 years. And then you ask yourself, how did this happen? How did Microsoft happen to me? How did UNICEF happen to me? And then you look at, and as you look at it very carefully, you'll find, except maybe some of the earliest ones, 9 out of 10 times the opportunity came to you. It is rare that you will find that you did something because you decided, you went and made all the effort, and you landed it. Okay. Maybe that was applicable early in your career where you decided, I want to go and study at that college. And you were very intentional and focused around it, and you achieved it. But since then, much of what happens is attracted into your life. I think there's something spiritual out here, but even if you leave the spirituality out, it comes down to two very practical things called your networks and your reputation. And if you built your reputation and your networks, you'd, like a fishing net, you'd land a bigger and bigger catch. And so I think this is very important to do, but maintain a balance and not go nuts into self-promotion.
Ravi, as we wrap up, a few questions where maybe just top of mind, one or two line responses. One leader who inspires you today in the way he or she is intentional about their life?
It's a difficult question, but off the top of my head, I would say a couple of the people who've endorsed my book. So Nandan Nilekani, for instance. He's my neighbor. He's been a friend and a mentor, and I've sort of really enjoyed and been inspired by the way he's evolved and made his transitions from being a founder at Infosys to going off and joining government and building Aadhaar, and then what he's done with India Stack in education, the work he and his wife Rohini do in philanthropy. I find that pretty inspiring.
What's the one insight from the book that's really struck a chord and resonated with the people that have read it?
I think the ideas which have got the most resonance is, stop looking for a job, figure out how fast to be a freelancer, passion economy. Another one is the idea of these super skills or meta skills. The notion that there is leadership capacity in every one of us, and there's leadership responsibility that we face. It's interesting because the audience is so diverse, Deepak. I think different things resonate with different people, particularly who are at different career stages, life stages.
The one lesson you've learned that you wish you'd known 10 years back?
I don't know about a lesson, but I certainly think I would care less about what others think or their approval or disapproval of my choices. I think I could have been freer much sooner.
And one choice in the past you would make differently with the wisdom of hindsight?
I think and I'm still actively working on it, I would choose to enjoy every day and every step of the journey more. I've had this tendency to always be in the future, thinking about what next, what to accomplish, instead of enjoying this moment much more. And I'm trying.
The one accomplishment that you value that the rest of the world doesn't know about?
Nothing. There's no accomplishment in that sense. But I do think there's something I do which I enjoy, which much of the world doesn't know about, which is Sonali and I, we take care of a lot of dogs, a lot of animals. We're part of a community that looks after a huge number of dogs, and gives us a lot of joy and pleasure and so forth. Yeah, so that's one thing.
Lovely. Ravi, as you know, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. Any summary thoughts to the listeners in the context of the book you've just written?
Yes, I think you're such a skilled interlocutor. It has caused me to become even more intentional about all these topics. So thank you.
Lovely. Thank you, Ravi. Thank you for listening. I hope you really found the conversation purposeful. A couple of quick messages before we wrap up. First, do rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you consume the content. I noticed that Spotify also recently introduced a feature where regular listeners can rate a show. It might seem like a repetitive ask, but trust me, over the long term, these small things can make a big difference in people discovering this podcast amidst a lot of noise, and also speakers getting comfortable with our platform in terms of them spending time with us. If you're interested in receiving short 2 minutes extracts of wisdom from the podcast, served up once or twice a week, consider signing up by sending a WhatsApp message to +91 85914 52129. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. Here we share short extracts across the various guests we have at the podcast. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Thank you, and hope to have you tune in to one of the subsequent conversations of the podcast. Bye now.